This is Coastside Conversations, and my guest today is Lena Miller, and she works with an organization with the very interesting name of Urban Alchemy. And I found out about Urban Alchemy when I was talking to somebody that is working for the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, and this is in regard to homelessness and housing homeless people. And again, it's around that issue of Half Moon Bay's Coastside Inn being bought by San Mateo County. And so Urban Alchemy is a very adaptable group, and they help in many situations regarding the homeless. So Lena, let's just talk to you about, how did this get started? How did Urban Alchemy come about, and what are the kinds of things you guys do?
Well, it actually started, it was a spinoff of another organization I founded 25 years ago called Hunters Point Family. It worked with a very different population, transitional age youth and youth living in public housing. We developed some workforce development programs because it didn't matter really what you put into the young people in the front end. If they weren't able to find work to support themselves and their families, they quickly got into the underground economy. So our first contract was servicing the public toilets, monitoring, servicing the whole nine. And I was more looking at it just as an employment opportunity for my constituents. And it kind of plunged me into this whole world of homelessness, because a lot of the public toilets were in areas where there's high incidences of homelessness and encampments. So people were using them as their only toilets or their primary toilets, as opposed to going on the street. I, at the time, because we had been so successful in that, several people started approaching us. Well, here's what made us successful. What people noticed, people meaning the city mostly, is that everywhere there was a toilet, there was reduced 311 calls, 911 calls, kind of crime, all the craziness seemed to reduce. And people, you know, they love talking to our staff, especially the one in City Hall. So I'd get a lot of feedback from people who worked in and around City Hall, like, oh, your guys are great and all that kind of stuff. And so they started asking me, well, can you do street cleaning? We're like, sure. So we have got a contract cleaning the Tenderloin. And then BART came to us and said, you know, they were having a problem in the elevators because people were using them as their primary toilets. And it was causing a problem for their disabled patrons who not only, you know, we're in a really disgusting little box in order to get around, but they were being attacked, they were being robbed, they were being stuck with needles, you know, people passed out in front of wheelchairs and they couldn't get by. So we started in the elevators. And then the folks around Civic Center had been trying to activate Civic Center in front of City Hall to UN Plaza to Market Street for years. And they said, do you think you can activate the space in front of City Hall? And it was a partnership with the Exploratorium. So we had some activities to engage with the public. And so we said, sure. And we completely transformed the area to the point where they put in two parks that are there now and they're absolutely beautiful, and of food trucks and buy right and activities and tables and chairs and all this kind of stuff. And it just kept growing and growing. We're also in Los Angeles. We do toilets, showers, street cleaning. We have the largest mobile shower program in the country, I believe. And so how we got into residential, I was asked to, when we were doing the toilets, you know, at the peak, probably of this was about 2 years ago, I was asked by some government officials in San Francisco if I would start a navigation center. And I was like, I don't know anything about this because they wanted to see something different. And, you know, I had a long history in the city. I've been there my whole life and running this nonprofit. And I was in the process of getting my doctorate at the time in psychology. So I was in the middle of a practicum and I was like, what? Run a shelter? Like, I don't know anything about that. It was like, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. It's not rocket science. You know, we'll support you. We just need to see something different. So I was like, okay. So I came up with this whole concept where it's like a spa, you know, all trauma-informed care, kind of with the idea that in order to get to the point where you're homeless, almost every time you've gone through a tremendous amount of life trauma. And then when you're living on the street, you go through a tremendous amount of trauma. So that was my specialty, right? What I was studying in psychology is trauma. And so what I try to do is kind of create this really healing place. Bought beautiful art to put everywhere on the wall. I got fountains donated. We had plants everywhere, beautiful places for people to sit with benches and all kinds of stuff, things for their dogs, doggy treats and jars, you know, just the whole nine where people walk in and they just feel, oh. And I made sure we treated people really well. And we had good food for people and all of that kind of stuff. And it became the number one shelter in San Francisco. This is according to people on the streets and hot team, government agencies. So I had to stop that. Once I got it launched, I had to go do my internship, which is the last year of your PhD in psychology, and it was full time. So I had to leave. And during that time, Urban Alchemy just kept churning, right? More and more people wanted more of our services. So I think the important thing to know about Urban Alchemy is that we prioritize hiring former long-term offenders. What that means is people who had life sentences. So life sentences, like you can get 10 to life, 20 to life, 30 to life, that those kind of sentences. What that means, you got a minimum of whatever the first number is up until life. Mm-hmm. In order to get out, you have to do a tremendous amount of work on yourself. Going to see a therapist in prison, going to groups, facilitating groups, and then you got to go before the board, which is a group of four people who basically scrutinize everything you ever did from birth to up until what got you put in prison and your behavior in prison. It's very thorough. It's very intense from what I've been told. But the point is that most of my guys spent a long time in prison, have done a lot of work on themselves and have seen a lot, obviously, you know, have been living hard lives. And, you know, because when you get out of prison, you know, it's not like people are bending over backwards to hire you. So it creates a different kind of mentality. People who are very, very serious of their work, very grateful to be working, people who are used to working, people who are not afraid of other people, people who understand mental illness, people who understand trauma, people who've done the work on themselves, and really understand de-escalation, right? Because in prison, particularly if you're trying to get out, you got two things to worry about. You got to worry about the COs, which is the correction officers who got guns pointed at you. And you have to worry about other inmates. So you don't really have the luxury, despite what a lot of people see on TV, of just going off and being crazy and punching somebody in the face, because it can have serious, serious consequences, not only for you, but whoever you're with. And everyone has to be with somebody, whether that be prison gangs or a group of people. So you really have to learn how to de-escalate and discern. Okay, so that's kind of the magic because, you know, in what we do. Now, we don't hire people who have crimes against women or children or sex offenders, because what we do is very intimate personal work and we're not trying to get into that. So
basically, most people who have those kinds of sentences, you know, not that we need to go into the specifics very much, but I mean, I've read many times, it's the people who've committed a murder that wind up getting those sorts of sentences and getting out.
Correct. Murder or attempted murder.
Okay, so this is an amazing story already. And we're going to go into it in more depth. And yes, we have to absolutely address the COVID-19 era. But I'm so fascinated by you. This is an amazing story already. I just want to just get a little bit of background on, okay, you started this nonprofit in Hunter's Point, but what happened before that? Who were you to get into this in the beginning?
Well, I was born and raised in Hunter's Point, saw and experienced a lot of trauma when I was 13 years old. So kind of coming of age, you know, the whole neighborhood had been really ravaged by crack and the crack epidemic. Mm. And watched before my eyes, like everybody else at that time, everything crumbled. Mm. You know, it was horrible. You watched all kinds of people, you know, middle class, working class folks who owned homes and had good jobs and stuff. And, you know, the crack just took over. And everything that went with that. So, you know, I went to school, but I had a lot of survivor's guilt. I mean, in college, I started out at UC Santa Cruz just to get away from everything, all the murder and craziness. And I went there because it had a lot of trees. And I figured I can just come down, you know. But Santa Cruz, anybody who really knows Santa Cruz, and you guys are up that way, and you know, it gets a little crazy in those trees. Those woods have some crazy energy. So I ended up transferring to UC Berkeley and working at a high school primarily that served kids from Hunter's Point in the special ed class. And, you know, saw the disparities of who got put in special ed. Most of the time it was behavioral stuff. And then I went to get a master's degree in social work. And I just kind of realized, like, I didn't want to be a social worker, you know, kind of be the change type of thing before it became popular. You know, it just seemed like as a social worker, it just seemed like it wasn't enough compared to the level of destruction, right? It's like, what does recycling do for global warming? It's helpful, sure, you know, and so, like, I would always say, like, we have to find bigger ways, you know, helping one person at a time is cool. But for me, it wasn't enough. I needed to see structural changes. Mm-hmm. So I took the track for administration and planning. I learned how to write proposals. I learned how to do budgeting, HR, all that kind of stuff. And I started a little program called Girls 2000 that would expand by a lot and eventually be called the Hunter's Point Family, you know, to reflect all of Hunter's Point. And then I just, you know, I felt like I was stuck. I couldn't get out of Hunter's Point. I couldn't open up to other opportunities. I had a lot of respect for the work that I did. My work was recognized everywhere. It had journal articles written about it, all kinds of stuff, but it felt like I couldn't get anywhere. I was ghettoized. Mm-hmm. So I just said, you know what? And plus the level of trauma that was going on in the community, and everyone was saying, oh, we know it's bad because the homicide rate was through the roof at the time. And everyone said, oh, we know it's bad. We know it's horrible. The problem is so big, we just don't know what to do. So at that time, USF was opening a doctorate in psychology program. They were looking for candidates. And so I was one of the first students of USF's University of San Francisco's doctorate in psychology program. And then, you know, just.
You created your own program to some extent. In other words, you informed what you were studying by your own experience, which was tremendous, I imagine, compared to a lot of people. So at that point, you could see enough, have enough experience to form your own program. What was your thesis, if you don't mind my asking?
No, it's fine. It was on the Phoenix Project. The Phoenix Project is just what you talked about. It was a program that was informed by evidence-based psychology practices. We had one of my professors and friends who is now the president of ABPSY, which is the National Black Psychology Organization, and some other folks. It was a community collective. So people from various nonprofits came together. We were funded by philanthropy. We beat out national nonprofits like the YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, all of that. And we based it on psychological principles like trauma-informed care, community-embedded programs, positive ethnic identity, motivational interviewing, like all kinds of stuff. And we incorporated, we manualized the program. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about it is that it was in every public housing community in Hunters Point, which had never been done before. So it's all under one umbrella. And so I did a qualitative with some quantitative evaluation of that program. And yeah, it works great. Usually, it's always common sense. It's always common sense. It's that you got to meet people where they are. You got to lead with love. You have to lead with respect. You have to understand that if people are living in certain conditions or have certain behaviors, most of the time it's because of trauma. It's not because of people are trying to be bad people. People are trying to they're doing the best that they can. Mm-hmm. And when you meet people there, oh, and strengths-based, I forgot to mention that, that's huge, and positive psychology. So when you meet people there, you look at their strengths, you don't focus on what's wrong with them. You focus on what's happened to them and their strengths and ways to overcome that. You fundamentally, it something changes in people, And so I use that same method, right? Everywhere I went, it was deliberate, but kind of just, like I said, it's really a common sense approach. So even with the SIPs and the residential work, I would tell my staff before we started, look, you get paid the same amount as what they make at the Hilton or the W. I expect you to treat. I fought hard to get people paid well. I'm like, we are not cheap labor, and we're very skilled and we need to be compensated. And then I can demand certain behavior too, or certain performance. But I would tell them, just think if some lady is, complaining because she ordered some potatoes and they were cold and it's very irritating, or somebody's next to, but you still are gracious, you're respectful. And it's the same thing here, in shelters and other places where you have people who are homeless or very poor. It's very customer service oriented. Mm-hmm. You should always be meeting people where they are. You should always be treating them with respect. You should lead with love in the general agape sense. And then usually you don't have too many problems with people. Sometimes people, have issues. They're either mentally ill or they're high or something like that, And so you just kind of, but like I said, most of my guys have seen a lot of that. So they know how to bring that down and mm-hmm. defuse it.
This is a wonderful, foundation. Thank you so much for this background. And now let's get into the specifics here. We would like to know more about the motel that you say is a big success that's on Lombard Street. How did you get into that particular contract or program? And then how has it evolved? What have you been doing over the last year or two that you've worked with that?
So that's the SIP story. So when the shelter in place thing went into effect, that was the first time most people had ever experienced that. So everyone is like freaking out. I gotta go home. Oh my God, And the city called me first. It was DPW and we were already running 24 hour toilets. And they said, we need you to staff up 15 more and we need it right away. So I did within 5 days. That's hiring over 120 people, getting them in the system, training them, getting them all scheduled and placing them at the toilets. That, and I think it was another like 30 hand washing stations around the city. We weren't at the hand washing stations 24 hours, but we serviced them twice a day.
You must have people lined up to go to work for you.
Well, I don't know if we have, but we have a hell of a recruiting system. People do now, they really want to work for us because they see us out there and they see our guys standing out there with dignity and purpose. They're not slouch smoking a cigarette, looking at their phone, trying to sell a little weed on the side or do something else slick. They're very, very serious about their work. And they're, you know, beautiful people to be engaged with. And so there is an attraction now, but it wasn't, but they would have these, you know, my people work, they mm-hmm. work. So when they were out there recruiting, they worked hard, mm-hmm. you know, and it was, we almost killed a few people. I mean, but we were all working, right? I stopped my internship because it was a shelter in place and all the therapists were trying to figure out how to do appointments by phone and Zoom anyway. So I was in San Francisco full time. My internship was out in Pleasanton and we all worked our butt off like around the clock to make it happen. And then right afterwards, I got a call from HSH, which is the city's homeless department. And they were like, can you staff some of these hotels? And so we were like, okay, sure. But we were like feeling very proud. You know, this is we get to staff a hotel. They came to us first because they know how wonderful our work was. And I thought that for a while. So we staffed three hotels, two hotels and one motel. So for a total of about 200 people. And then they turned around and Jeff Kaczynski, who was the director at the time, he said, look, just don't max yourself out. Just promise me you're gonna save some people for the Safe Sleeping Village. We're doing a big one on Fulton Street. Promise me you're gonna do that. So I was like, you know, of course we will. And later me and Jeff were sitting down and I was bragging to him. That's why they called us first to do the hotels. And he laughed at me. He said, you think they called you first? He said, they didn't even call you last. He said, they couldn't get any other providers wouldn't do it. He said, then they came to me and say, what do we do? And he said, well, call Urban Alchemy. They said, they don't do this work. He said, they might see what they say. So that was the joke about it. And so we did the first three SIP hotels. And then all the other providers who've been doing this residential stuff forever, they came afterwards. But we knocked it out of the ballpark. They raided all the hotels. There's a bunch of them now with all the regular providers. You know, we came in number two in terms of quality. That's still a hell of a feat.
It's amazing. I just want to, just for the clarity of the people listening, SIP means shelter in place. Now you have a special hotel, I think, on Lombard Street. So what is special about it, or why is that something that you brought up in particular?
We let the other two hotels go once the other providers started coming in. So it's our only SIP hotel. Now it's a motel. Mm-hmm. Because we really wanted to focus on the village, and the village went from 50 people to 150.
Wow.
And we thought that's where the action is. And so we moved people. Like I said, they had enough providers. The Safe Sleeping Village was something that was new and hot and interesting. And so we thought it would be best. And no one was doing it like us, like the other providers can handle the hotels. But the reason why we didn't let that one go is because we fell in love with it. And yeah, I mean, it runs like clockwork, and it was just, just beautiful. And our people kept it immaculate to the point where the owners are trying to get us to take over a long-term master lease. And all the neighbors are saying it's better now than it was before when it was run as a regular motel.
Wow.
We keep it immaculate. We keep it safe. You know, we make sure we deliver food to everybody. We put it in baskets. You know, at first it was like, just put it on the floor in front of No, we got baskets so people's food wouldn't be on the floor. We do safety and wellness checks. We take people's temperature. You know, it's just a beautiful, beautiful place, and people love being there.
That's awesome. That's really so great.
Yeah. And now we're starting our second Safe Sleeping Village. So
now, please tell me, what does that mean, Safe Sleeping Village? I'm not aware of that.
So we actually coined the term village. So first they were calling it Can't Breathe. And there was a bunch of tents in front of City Hall, a little bit further down in front of the library on Fulton Street. And so the city said, okay, let's turn this into, because of COVID, like, let's get everyone social, because they were all bunched up. There was about 80 tents and there was no space between them. They had a lot of drug dealers were just standing there and, you know, just selling drugs. Like, you drive by there, it was like seven drug dealers in front of all these tents and it was just bad. So the city said, okay, let's space these people out. Let's bring some amenities like a toilets. Let's make sure people have food and water and hand washing stations. We eventually brought our shower down there. So our shower's down there. So they fenced it off. And that was really hard getting people to trust and move, but we did it. The police were there first trying to get people to move. And DPW, we told them, you know what? We got it. Just go home. And at first they were like, what? Police were cool about it, actually. They're like, we don't want any of this stuff anyway. But, you know, DPW, we're leaving. We're not going to come. That's okay. You don't have to come back. We got a cleaning crew. We'll do it. So we talked to people. It took a long time, but we got people to move in their squares. And then, you know, we added the amenities and all of it came together. So now we have 150 tents in the area, right, a block away from City Hall between that and UN Plaza. And it's a model that a lot of unhoused people actually said they wanted. The Coalition on Homelessness did a pretty extensive report and interviewed lots of people. And I think like 58% of homeless people said they prefer that model. And like 44% of those were living in a shelter at the time. And so now some cities are doing this and we're trying to advance to that, evolve to that, is you put tiny houses instead of the tents, you know?
Yeah, I actually saw those being built over in Oakland. There was a program called Dykes with Drills that was doing training for people to learn how to make these tiny houses that are just a trailer with a bedroom on top. And then they have these showers like you have, you know, you're talking about showers. They have these big mobile units that have bathrooms and showers.
Yep.
And then they also have these kind of yurts here and there that are like, this is where the kitchen is. This is where the like social support people are. And they have a village near the airport in Oakland there. And it's for kids who've aged out of the foster system. It gives them a transition time. So they have this sort of tiny house village. And it's really cool. And it's got murals on it and everything. It's really kind of neat the way they've got it set up. But anyway, I digress. So I like the idea of the bedroom, so because it's easier on people, it's much better insulated and things like that.
For sure. And people don't all come with, some people don't even have tents. They just have pieces of cardboard and other stuff that they kind of put together. And it's rough, but I think the better you can make life for people, you know, it's like you kind of move the needle on the social weather, if that makes sense.
Yes, that makes sense.
I think it affects the larger microclimate, you know, and that's kind of what, when we talk about urban alchemy, that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about actually performing alchemy in environments. And so that's why, you know, earlier when we were talking, I'm like, we always say like, give us a broom, give us a toilet, a shower, a motel, a hotel, a safe sleeping village. We also run the Vehicle Triage Center, which is where people live. San Francisco's only place where people who live in their vehicles can be. Like, it's all a prop, you know? For us, it's really, that's just something that we're doing while we're really doing our magic. And our magic is to transform the energetic environment around us. And we do that with relationships.
Wow, that is so cool. Gosh, Lena, I am just so impressed with your energy, your vision, your inspiration. It's awesome. I would like to just ask you one question. And this is kind of what you're talking about, this weather, you know, moving the social weather. In this environment that we just talked about, the sleeping village where people can, you know, be socially distanced and safe, but they're still homeless out there. What have you seen happen to those people over the last 6 months or so? How has your alchemy metamorphosed? You know, what's the transformation that's going on?
Well, the first thing that I think happens is that when people are living out on the street, they're susceptible to everything that goes on, especially when you're talking about urban centers downtown. There's a tremendous amount of assaults, rapes. People get their stuff stolen. It's hard for them to get out and go to work. And there are lots of people working who are living in those tents, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. For them to get their documents, you know, or the little, anytime they leave, you know, it's difficult. And so the first thing that they can do is just breathe. Their cortisol starts to come out. And instead of being in survival mode all the time, you know, they can start to do some kind of forward thinking, some future thinking, some reflection, because they move out of survival mode. Mm-hmm. They use less drugs, because I learned that a lot of people, the meth got so big, particularly around the homeless population, because people have to stay up at night, because mm-hmm. that's when a lot of stuff happens. So they need something to kind of keep them up all night long. So the drug use starts to go down. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, and then even the opioids, you know, people are just trying to numb themselves out from the reality of what's going on. I think in, you know, if you want to just look at data, I think the last count I heard, it was like something like 150 people we've moved from the village to like permanent housing of some sort. Either, you know, they've got apartments, or moved in with family members, or going back home to wherever they're from. But they've been moved out of homelessness. And that's, so we have a support person, case manager type person, that really, they liaison with other organizations that in the city to kind of figure those things out. So we're not doing the heavy lifting in terms of that part of the case management, but we are doing the heavy lifting in terms of the relationship to do the warm handoff, so they feel they trust the person enough, or to go gather their documents. Like, we actually have to take them to the Department of Public Health and get their birth certificate, or take them down to Social Security, or get online and do that kind of stuff. So really, somebody just being with a person and kind of hand holding them and being their cheerleader, so that they can get to the place, like I said, where they really, you know, start doing some more planning, you know, and different kind of thinking. So I think it's extremely successful. I mean, it's hard to live on the streets.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's scary. It's dangerous. Like, there's a lot of stuff, man. People really get abused out on the streets. And I think what we offer is a way where people don't have to feel controlled like they do in a shelter, like everyone is watching them. They have their little privacy, but they're safe. Mm-hmm. They're safe.
Yeah, it changes everything just to be able to, like you say, that cortisol goes down. They're not in constant anxiety mode. So I really see that. I see what you're saying. And to have moved so many people to permanent housing is such an obvious sign of success. That's awesome. So one of the things I just want to ask you, hopefully, is, do you guys work outside of San Francisco? I mean, is this a, I don't want to say it in a way, like, I mean, what you do, I think, is something that nobody can duplicate. It's coming from inside of you. You're the inspiration. But I'm wondering, is your organization big enough that you could have, you know, some people working on the peninsula or in Half Moon Bay? Or is this like just, it has to be in an urban environment?
Well, like I said, we are in LA. We're also in Oakland and Berkeley, although to a smaller extent with the showers. I think, so there's two ways. One, I think if the contract is, if it's big enough, then we can kind of set up shop in enough, because you gotta be able to supervise people closely, right? You gotta make sure that everything is tight and working right. So I think if it's big enough, then we can send people, we can make sure that there's an infrastructure set up so we can sit on it, you know, and make sure everything is going well. The other thing that we do and we're working with is that we can provide consulting and training. So what that would be is because we do understand that not every city wants to deal with outsiders, you know, especially if there's already service providers there. People tend to get real, you know, why would you give the resources to them when we've been doing the work the whole, you know, that kind of thing. So we get it. Mm-hmm. But basically like a franchise model. So we can help them recruit. We can give them the training. We can give them the structure and then check on them, have a liaison where somebody, they can always pick up the phone and ask for expertise or go visit and, you know, help them tighten up.
That's awesome. That's great. And so if an organization already does some work with the homeless or something like it, you're willing to, for paid time, in other words, as a consultant, help them set up a program and train them. Is that the idea?
Correct. And that would either be me, but we have, I mean, our bench is deep and wide. Mm. We have a phenomenal group of directors. So I'm saying like we, you know, the whole kit and caboodle with really training people what to do. We have, you know, our trainings are both PowerPoint and we have some extremely dynamic facilitators, but also recorded. And that's for our staff because we have over 650 staff between here and LA. So we do try to, make sure that we have ways that we can provide that training and keep it updated and have several levels, one for entry level and then one for leadership that really talks about those that next level of how you have to look at a program and put it together and interact with the public and all that kind of stuff.
Very good. Excellent. I mean, it's awesome that this is something that in a way can be replicated. And so that's very good to know. Very valuable. Again, Lena, I'm just so impressed and so excited that this is possible and what you're doing is really wonderful work. I am going to have to, you know, kind of come to an end here. I just want to thank you so much for everything. Wow, it sounds like an extremely valuable program and approach to me. And so thank you so much for your time. I think it's really inspiring, honestly.
Thank you. And thank you for giving us the platform to, you know, even talk about our work. It means a lot to us. I'm very grateful.